Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. What a cool place. Okay. So I want to start by pretty much telling you what the point of the talk is. And to do that, I just need to find two spaces real quick. So first, there's a Grassmannian of K-planes in n-dimensional, the Grassmannian of K-planes in n-dimensional space, so set of K-dimensional subspaces of a complex vector space. And how I will think about it today is, first let me say that I fixed a vector space V, which has dimension K. And I also am always going to call G, I'm always going to call SLK G, because one day it will be a simple Lie group. And also, I'll let N be a unipotent, maybe fixed choice of maximal unipotent inside SLK. Okay, so Grassmannian, how I think about it is n tuples of vectors in this vector space considered up to SLV action. Actually, the Grassmannian consists of n tuples of vectors considered up to GLV action. And so today I will want to think of them as SLV, so I have to put a tilde over this, and the tilde means instead of taking the projective variety, which is the Grassmannian, I take this affinization of it. So it's dimension one bigger. So this is the affine cone over the Grassmannian. And I think of it as n tuples of vectors considered up to SLV action. And the second space I'm thinking about is this space which I call FG, but no one else does. FG of KN. And for this, I'm thinking about n tuples of, so I'm thinking of points in G mod N. I call a point in G mod N an affine flag. And I take an n tuple of these, and I consider them up to SLV action. And the reason I want to talk about this space is, for those of you who have already seen stuff like this, this is this Fock-Gontarov cluster A space. And it's the moduli space of decorated SLK local systems. In a disk with endpoints on its boundary. Okay. So if you already know and like these spaces, this is the one. This is what this is. But if you don't, it's all right. Okay, and the punchline. Punchline one is that, before the punchline, let me say that both of these structures, or both of these spaces, have the structure of a cluster variety. So they have, I'm going to tell you about that, but just whatever that is, they have this structure. And the first punchline is that the braid group BK, so this is the braid group on K strands, acts on the Grassmannian G KN whenever K divides N, so GRK RK, by symmetries of the cluster structure. Okay, that's the first part of the punchline. And one of the things I'll do is to say what I mean by symmetry. And the second part of the punchline is that basically the cluster structure in this space, GRK, where K divides N, and the cluster structure in this Fock-Gontarov space of an even number of affine flags are the same up to frozen variables Okay, so I'm also going to tell you what the same means, but basically, the notion of symmetry is the same notion that makes the sameness. And so if you like Fock-Kontrov spaces, you know, you get a break group action on the Fock-Kontrov space also. Because basically, the break group acts on this thing, and these two things are the same. So I'm mostly going to talk about Grassmannians today, but yeah. Okay, that's the punchline. Now I'll tell you why, what this gives you, and yeah. Okay, any questions? Okay, what's the braid group? I'm guessing most people know it, but here's an example of a braid. A braid on three strands would look something like this. That's a braid on three strands. So you have some strands are allowed to cross over each other, either over or under. You multiply them by stacking them and consider them up to isotopy. OK. This would be an element of B3. OK. Good. OK, so to start, I'm going to say a little bit about cluster algebras, cluster varieties. So let X be an affine algebraic variety so that I can talk about its coordinate ring, C of X. So saying that it has a cluster structure, it provides us with some things. And I'm not making a definition. I'm telling you like what those things are. So saying X is a cluster variety provides us with, or maybe I should say a cluster structure on X provides us with some stuff. Okay, so first it provides us with cluster variables. So these are just some things. Here's some symbols to describe it. So a cluster variable is a regular function on my variety. And all you need to know is that the indexing set for this thing goes from 1 to m, or 1 to n plus m for some technical reason I'll explain in a second. And then there's a cluster variable for each I and also for each t, and t is just in some indexing set. Okay. Whatever. And these things, these cluster variables, are grouped into clusters. So we have some regular functions, and they come grouped in clusters. And I'll denote a cluster like this. And it consists of all this stuff with the same value of t. So x1 of t up to xn plus m of t. So I think of t as being like time. And at each time, I have some list of regular functions. And once you know this stuff and you know this stuff, what this buys you is the definition of a cluster monomial. And what's a cluster monomial? Is a monomial in the elements of X of t for any t. That's the definition of a cluster monomial. And why might you care about cluster structures? There's kind of a bunch of reasons, but the one that I want to do to start this talk is to say that the set of cluster monomials is always linearly independent. I haven't told you what they are, so you can't be that surprised. But it's always linearly independent. This was a hard theorem. It took people like 10 years to prove. And forms part of, or is expected to form part of, a canonical basis for the coordinate ring. And canonical basis means that in a few special instances where X is a variety where we already know what a definition of a canonical basis is from like representation theory, then the cluster monomials are part of that canonical basis. And in general, there's way more cluster algebras than there are examples where we know what a canonical basis is. So this is a machine for cooking that kind of thing up. Yeah?
Useful to say what kind of a set T is.
I'm going to say that like in it's a discrete set, right? It's like time, but at each moment in time, you're allowed to move in capital N directions. That's how you should think of it. But I'm going to do an example now. So, okay, an example. Yeah.
The motivation for the punchline. I mean, why are you interested in this, or where does it come from?
Yeah. Okay, I can tell you quickly. So the way you find cluster variables, okay, let's say my goal is to find what the canonical basis is. So the easy way to do that would be to start with a cluster and just act by the braid group. I get infinitely many clusters this way without doing anything. So that's why. If you want to know all cluster monomials, you can either do this complicated definition I'm about to show you, or you can just act by the braid group and you get clusters for free without doing anything.
Actions are interesting for all kinds of reasons, like non-variance. Does this connect with other
So like I don't know of any other thing that implies this action yet. Yeah.
That's what I was asking. Does this tell you there's anything interesting about knots, for instance?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know that either. Yeah. I don't know of an application or a way to find the action. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know of neither. Yeah. Okay, and so let me just tell you like a picture in your head where you can see what all these things are. So the example of GR to N. So what's GR to N? I have N vectors in C2, and I can set them up to SL2 action. What's a nice function on that space? I can take the determinant of the matrix that has vi and vj in it. I call that delta ij. That's a function on this space. I'm going to stop writing tildes if that's OK. Just g2n is the affine cone from now on. And that's called a Plucker coordinate. This function, delta ij, is called a Plucker coordinate. Okay, and so how can I see cluster variables and stuff like that in terms of Plucker coordinates for G2N? As an example, let's take G26. What you do is you draw a hexagon because we're in G26. And I have delta ijs. So an example of a delta ij might be I take the determinant of the second vector and the fourth vector, and I draw it like that. Or I take the determinant of the fourth vector and the sixth vector, or the second vector and the sixth vector. So this is delta 2,6. This is delta 2,4. This is delta 4,6. Okay. Each of the green things happens to be a cluster variable in this cluster structure that exists on this space. And the set of these three things is a cluster, it turns out. Okay, so the recipe here is that cluster variables are delta ijs, so arcs, and clusters are triangulations. And cluster monomials are products of arcs that don't cross each other. By the way, there's also these arcs here. Those are legit arcs, so delta 1,6, delta 1,2, delta 2,3, those are arcs too. Cluster monomials are products of arcs that don't cross each other, and they form a basis in this case. Equals products of arcs that don't cross. So that's what these definitions turn out to be for G2N. And I still haven't told you like an axiomatic structure that allows you to figure out these things, but whatever that structure is, this is what the answer is for G2N. Okay, getting back to your question. So like for knots, you know, you can use skein relations to, I use skein relations to like prove stuff like this, but I don't know how to apply it to, yeah, okay.
It's no way to take a trace.
Yeah, I think like traces of stuff corresponds to stuff that's not in the cluster algebra. Yeah, but this isn't a vector, like, I'm not acting on, oh yeah, on the corner ring.
Right.
Yeah, right, okay, that's, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Does this commute, this action commute the action of any of the other symmetries in the class money, like GL, K, GK or something?
On the, like, opposite side.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don't think so. We'll see when I tell you. You can tell me. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Good. And I'm going to tell you really quickly what the axiomatic structure that produces this stuff looks like, but I'm not really going to make every definition. Okay. Okay. So how should you think of this process? How to produce clusters? Like, what's the definition? How to produce clusters? Okay, so the rule is you start with some initial cluster, X of T naught. Just pick your favorite place to start. And let's say, like in the picture I'm gonna draw right now, that capital N equals 3. Then the axioms say that at each time, there's an operation you're allowed to do called mutation, and you can do either mu 1, mu 2, or mu 3, where 3 is this 3. So there are 3 directions I can go at each instant in time. And when I do that, I get some new clusters, and let's call them like T1, T2, and T3. Okay. And then the axioms say there's a new way to produce clusters, but one of the things that's true is that if I do mu 2 twice, I get back to where I started. Or if I do mu anything twice, I get back to where I started. So there's only 2 new directions to go at each time in this case. So I'd produce 2 new clusters here, something and something. I'd produce 2 new clusters here, something and something, and so on. Okay. And in general, how you get all the clusters is you start at some place and you keep going doing whatever mutations you want. And so I haven't told you how to do a mutation yet, but that's what the structure is. And the set of all things you get this way is the set of clusters. The set of things that show up in the clusters is the set of cluster variables, et cetera. So it's a recursive procedure. Okay, and so what is mu k? Two parts. First of all, in addition to keeping track of clusters, you have to keep track of a second piece of data, which is called a quiver. Okay, and so instead of just thinking of the cluster being here, there's also a quiver at time t naught, a quiver at time t1, and so on. So every cluster knows what its quiver is. So Q of T is a directed graph on the vertices 1 up to n plus m. Q of T's have their own mutation rule. It's combinatorial. So what I mean is, suppose I don't keep track of the clusters, I just keep track of the q's. Then there's a way to do mu 1 to q, mu 2 to q, and so on. And this rule is just in terms of the graph. Like if edges go this way, do this. If edges go this way, do this. Something like that. Okay. Okay. And the reason you need these things is because to do mu k to a current cluster, what you do is you replace the current cluster variable xk at this time by a new guy, some new x prime. X prime will be an xk at the adjacent t prime. Via a formula in terms of x1 of t up to xn plus m of t. So in terms of the current guys. And the formula depends on q of t. So it's this formula is a rational function in terms of the current cluster variables, and the specific way of writing the formula depends on this like combinatorial data of a quiver. Okay. Depending on q of t. Okay, that's the axiomatic structure. I'm not going to tell you what the formula is, but it's explicit. Okay. And let me just show you an example where you can kind of see what it looks like. Here, each of these guys, we're allowed to mutate them. Here, n is 3. And let's say we want to mutate 2, 6. Then the rule to mutate 2, 6 that I'm not telling you tells us that the thing that I get when I mutate, which I was calling x prime, is defined by a formula in terms of the current guys. And the formula in this case happens to be delta 1, 2, delta 4, 6, plus delta 1, 6, delta 2, 4, divided by delta 2, 6. That's what the formula looks like, some explicit expression. And it turns out that the thing that satisfies this is another Plucker coordinate. And so if you know Plucker relations, the thing that satisfies this is exactly delta 1, 4. And pictorially, to mutate this guy, what you do is it's in a quadrilateral, and you find like the thing that makes a kite. That's how cluster structure on G2N works.
What is the quiver?
Oh yeah, what is the quiver? I have to tell you that. Thank you. Yeah, the quiver for this. Thanks for asking. What you do is you have a triangulation, and you just inside each small triangle draw another small triangle.
Can you draw another diagram?
Yeah. Sure. Okay. Let's do it over here. Okay. So. Here's this stuff is fixed, and I chose this triangulation. So these dotted things are my cluster variables. And the quiver looks like this. So I just drew small triangles inside. So the vertices. Not the best picture. Okay, you get the idea probably. So there's 9 vertices for this quiver here because there are 6 boundary edges and 3 in the interior. Okay. Okay, and I'm glad you asked that question because.
Are there any relations for that quiver in this example?
Right. So it encodes the monomial. It encodes this thing, for example. Is that maybe what you're asking? Do you mean quiver with relations?
Yeah. That's
fascinating. I think there's like this thing you can choose called a potential, but
yeah,
at
so
the moment.
Yeah,
I don't know what its potential is because I don't think about that kind of thing.
Okay.
Probably there's a canonical choice. Ian, do you know?
There
is a right choice, yeah, but I don't know what it is. Yeah. Okay, good. So let me just say that this whole recipe could be generalized to a surface. This can be generalized to a surface. S with boundary and with marked points. And what I mean by that is there is a cluster algebra in which cluster variables are arcs connecting marked points, clusters are triangulations, the quiver is drawn by like drawing these little yellow triangles, et cetera. There is such a cluster algebra. The functions here were nice, they were Plucker coordinates, the functions there become functions on this Fock-Gontarov space of SL2 local systems decorated by stuff. There's a meaning for the functions. why I'm gonna care about that today is the mapping class group of the surface acts on the cluster structure by symmetries. I'll say more about that in a second. But let me just say here in the disk, you can take a triangulation and you can rotate it. You can take a triangulation and you can flip it. And dihedral symmetries send cluster variables to cluster variables. They preserve clusters because they preserve triangulations. And they preserve the quivers because our rule for quivers was like combinatorial. And in general, the mapping class group is going to take a triangulation and maybe twist it a lot around a handle or something like that, but it doesn't, it sends cluster variables to clusters, sends clusters, et cetera. Okay. So that's basically what I'm meaning by symmetry is acting on cluster variables, preserving clusters, preserving quivers. Acting on cluster variables, and so if your goal is to find every cluster monomial, an action like this is nice because up to the action of the mapping class group, there's only finitely many triangulations. You can untwist every triangulation. So even though there's infinitely many cluster variables because there's infinitely many arcs, you can untwist them, and so you can, you know, reduce everything to some finite check. Okay. Good. Next page of notes. Okay, so now I want to tell you about Grassmannians. What do we know about Grassmannians? We know everything about G2N. What's next? What do we know about Grassmannians? You might guess that it can't get that much harder. It does get a lot harder. Okay, so let me tell you. Okay, first of all, there are two things you can ask in general for a cluster algebra. One is, when does a cluster algebra have only finitely many clusters? And you can ask the same question for quivers also. Okay. Right, so this recipe I told you here, it looks like you'll get infinitely many clusters, but it can happen that, you know, I mutate somewhere and I get back to where I started. So things can fold up. And this is what happens for the Grassmannian because there's only finitely many triangulations. So G2N is an example where you have only finitely many clusters and only finitely many quivers. And the answer to the first question is, there's an ADE type classification. So for example, G2N has type A n minus 3. It's Dinkin type n minus 3. So this one I did would be A3 type quiver. OK. I'm going to answer. There are two questions here, question one and question two. Let me tell you about Grassmannians. So here are some Grassmannians where we do know everything, G36, G37, G38. OK, well, those ones are nice. This has finitely many clusters. It's type D4. This has finitely many clusters. It's type E6. These have finitely many clusters. It's type E8. Convenient fun fact is you might ask about E7. Well, it is actually equal to, it is the space of 5 affine flags in SL3. So E7 shows up also in this list. OK, what about G39? Answer, there's infinitely many cluster variables. But it's of this type, so it has only finitely many quivers. So G39 has infinitely many cluster variables, but finitely many quivers.
Are there quivers?
So in these cases, so first of all, something I've kind of been ignoring, it's always ignored, is for example, here, I have a quiver on 9 vertices. I have to forget about the frozen stuff. Frozen.
It's like affine A.
This is A3, and right, it doesn't look like A3, but there's another triangulation of this thing. This one. And for that one, when I do the process, the quiver I get is this, which is just normal A3. When I said ADE type classification, it's a little subtle. It's like you have to forget about the frozen vertices, and then you have to mutate appropriately until you get an orientation of a Dinkin quiver. That's the classification. OK. So this thing is some kind of tame type thing, because it has infinitely many clusters but finitely many quivers. That, I call it tame. No one else calls it that. But the same is true for G48. It has infinitely many cluster variables and finitely many quivers. So it's like these examples of surfaces we had where somehow things are obtained by Dane twisting a lot or something like that. Infinitely many cluster variables, finitely many quivers. OK, and besides the things I've just listed, there's nothing that's like well behaved. Past here, there's infinitely many of everything. Past here or going down, there's infinitely many of everything. By the way, I don't include G37 because G37 is I don't include G47 because G47 is G37 and so on. Like you can take complements, so there's nothing interesting there. But okay.
Is G39 your name?
Yeah. So they're sort of Dinkin-y style names. Is they're elliptic E8 and elliptic E7. So elliptic is like one worse than affine. The Cartan matrix has degeneracy 2. So this is like E8, I call it tilde tilde. And this is like E7 tilde tilde. OK. And let me tell you one more reason why you might care about these tilde tilde things. Okay, so this is a theorem, which is proved by like a really long, well, like they thought a while and then they did a really long exhaustive computer search, which is, so suppose Q has a, so it's a quiver, and without frozen vertices. So suppose Q has a finite mutation class. What I mean by that is I have some quiver, I apply the muse as much as I want willy-nilly, and I only get finitely many things out.
That's your second question.
That's my second question, right? Yeah, answer to two. Yeah, the first question was ADE. Second question was then Q comes from a surface. And there's a big, huge, infinite list of those. There's a lot of them. Or it looks like this. It's E6, E7, or E8. It's the affine versions of these things. It's the elliptic versions of these things. Or it's one of two random extra ones that just happen by a computer search and no one really has anything to say about. But they're there. Or it's X6 or X7. I don't know anything about them, but okay, they're there. So morally speaking, like the only cases where you have like, okay, so what I mean to say is we already know these Grassmannians, and if you figure out like these last few, then you kind of know everything that is well behaved.
Yeah. You haven't included D4 limits.
Oh yeah, yeah. It happens that the D's all come as surfaces. They're a once punctured disk. A once punctured disk with some stuff on the boundary, endpoints on the boundary, is Dn. Okay. Okay. So I mean, the goal would be like to have nice concrete descriptions like arcs and triangulations for these things. And I can answer this for the two Grassmannians using the braid group. Okay, so I'm going to delay that part of it for. Oh, let me say a small amount. I'm going to wait till that'll be the last part of the talk where I kind of talk about what the application is to G39 and G38, but G48. I want to talk about the braid group now. Okay. Right. So first, I'm going to define the braid group action. Okay, so first I have to remind you a little bit about the braid group. The braid group is the group that has presentation sigma 1 up to sigma k minus 1, satisfying like Coxeter style relations, but they're not involutions. So sigma I, sigma j equals sigma j, sigma I, and sigma I, sigma I plus 1, sigma I equals sigma I plus 1, sigma I, where here j and I are far apart. Okay, that's a presentation. I plus 1, thank you. And what is sigma I? It's the braid that does this. I have strands 1 up to k. I have I and I plus 1. I don't do anything to these guys. This guy I cross over, and this guy I pass under. And I don't do anything to the rest. That's sigma I. I call that an Artin generator. OK, because Artin gave this presentation. OK, so for the Grassmannian, for GKN, where N equals RK, here's how to, I'm going to define a map, sigma I from the Grassmannian to itself. And the way to do that is to say what happens to N vectors. And how do you do that? What I want you to think is that I have vectors v1 up to vk, or let's do this picture over here. I have vectors v1 up to vk, and then I have vectors vk plus 1 up to v2k, and then I keep doing that, grouping them in groups of k, vn minus k plus 1 up to vn, okay? And I want to produce vectors v1 prime up to vk prime, and so on. OK, and let's just talk about what sigma 1 does. The rest are analogous. What does sigma 1 do? It doesn't do anything to V3 up to VK. It just. OK, and it does something to these two. And the guy who passes under just gets sent to, just stays itself. OK, so what I'm saying is V1 prime equals V2. Right. The guy who crosses over, something interesting happens. Here's what he does. I'll write the formula, then I'll explain what the formula means. I take these two vectors and I wedge them together. I should write wedges. Okay, that's a element of if wedge 2. And then I do this thing called like the meat operation, or there's different definitions of it, but I'll talk about it in a second. I take the vectors v3 up to vk plus 1 and I wedge them together. That's in wedge to the k minus 1 of v. And there's a unique way to take something of like degree 2, something of degree k minus 1, and a k-dimensional vector space and get a vector out of it. That's SLV equivariant. OK. And that vector, this vector lies in the space spanned by this, the space spanned by this. Take the intersection of those two spaces. If that intersection is too small, then this will be 0, but that's fine. Yeah, OK. OK, that's the rule. And then you repeat the rule like every k. That's the action. This is a map from the Grassmannian to itself. And its pullback is a function of the Grassmannian. Or its pullback is an algebra map on the corner ring. So, and let's say some things about its pullback. I can erase my punchline now because I'm going to restate. Vn plus 1 is V1, maybe with a sign too. Yeah, kind of not talking about that, but yeah. But yeah, that's right. So yes, so my picture kind of breaks down over there is what you're saying. in my picture, or no, it's fine, right?
Yeah, it's fine. You need to say
like,
the indices are defined.
The indices are defined mod k, yeah. Okay, mod, yeah. Mod k and mod n. Okay. Okay. So the theorem is that there's a lot of things you could have done with vectors. I mean, the theorem is like this is a very well-behaved map for cluster structures. So the theorem. OK, so there's two parts of the theorem. One part of the theorem is each sigma I star thought of as a map from the coordinate ring to itself satisfies a bunch of nice properties. OK, so first, sigma I star applied to a frozen variable. I have to talk about those a little bit. OK, you remember in G2n, there are these boundary arcs. When you flip triangulations, they never change. So they're frozen. Somehow, like the cluster algebra structure commutes with just forgetting about the frozens. So you can always set them equal to 1. So they're not very important. They're important for getting this. If you care about this particular algebra, you have to have frozen variables. But if you just care about cluster combinatorics, they're not important. OK. So and for the Grassmannian, the frozen variables look like this. For example, the frozen variables for G36 are this guy up to this guy, so solid minors. Plus cyclically solid minors, so 1, 5, 6, 1, 2, 6. Those are the frozens for G36. So just certain Pluka coordinates, cyclically solid. Okay, so whatever. You're supposed to think those guys aren't important. And when I apply sigma star to them, I get a product of them. So unimportant stuff is sent to product of unimportant stuff. Okay? Important stuff, AKA cluster variables. So if I take sigma I star and apply it to a cluster variable, I get a cluster variable back. Let's just call it some extra guy, xi of t bar. It's some new cluster variable. But I don't actually get a cluster. I get it up to the unimportant stuff, so times a product of frozens. Where this is a cluster variable, and this is a cluster variable, but it's a new cluster variable. And I'm calling bar the operation that takes old cluster variable to new cluster variable. And it does this in a way that preserves clusters and preserves quivers. Sigma I star sends clusters to clusters and quivers to quivers. Okay. And this is where, and I guess part two of the theorem is that the braid relations are satisfied. So. Okay, part two says that the sigma I stars, the Artin generators, satisfy the relations, again, only up to frozen monomials. Okay, so if you just set all frozen variables to one, then you get a braid group action on the Grassmannian, the part of it where I've killed certain Pluka coordinates or set them equal to one. And it sends cluster variables to cluster variables, sends clusters to clusters, and this is how the braid group acts on the Grassmannian. And this is an easy action. I mean, you can just write what happens to vectors by iterating a bunch of maps using wedges and stuff like that. That's the definition. Okay. Any questions about that? Maybe I'll just say, like, the proof of this is just a calculation with determinants. The proof of this is there's all these definitions make sense for cluster algebras, and there's a general structural notion here, and you know, you can check that the structure is true in this case. So this is like an abstract thing that's true for cluster algebras, that if you have maps with certain properties, you get all these consequences. Okay. Good. I also want to mention, like I told you in the beginning of the talk, that Grassmannians and Fock-Gontrau spaces are basically the same thing. So I want to tell you a map from a bunch of vectors to a bunch of points to a bunch of points in G mod n mod SLK. And the map is what you might guess. So I have vectors v1 up to vn, and again, I group them in k's. And the first k, what I'm going to do is send them to two points in g mod n. The first one is just the columns, just v1 through vk. Think of it as a matrix. Think of it as a point in g mod n. And I get a second point in g mod n by writing them in the reverse order. Okay, so I have, I group vectors in k's, I produce two points, two g mod n's, and this recipe makes sense. It gives us a map from the functions here to the functions here, and the fact is that all these properties which are true for the sigma i's are also true for this map. So cluster variables are sent to cluster variables except frozens, clusters are sent to clusters except frozens, and so on. Same stuff is true. It's true for the resulting map from FG to GRKN. Okay. And this is kind of surprising because these two spaces, they're like not, they're not birationally isomorphic, they have different dimensions. They're really different spaces. But like the cluster structures on them can just be identified canonically if you ignore frozen variables. And somehow this is the only, this is the right way to do it. By the way, and there's a reverse map. I told you some nice map from vectors to points in G mod n. There's a pretty much just as nice map, but I don't want to write it down, that takes stuff like this and produces vectors. And these two maps are inverse except frozen variable monomials. Okay. So, you know, once you know that these spaces are canonically identified with each other, you get some braid group action here. And I wrote it down, it doesn't look as nice. I think like it's very easy to understand this thing in terms of vectors. It's like a little bit more complicated here, but probably if you think of it the right way, it's just as simple. Okay, and in the last 5 minutes, I'll say how you, like what the answer is for G39 and for G48. Starting with G39. Okay. So I want to tell you what cluster variables look like here. So before, a cluster variable was some arc. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Okay, so if I am in a three-dimensional vector space, I can't pair together vectors. What I can do is take a 3x3 determinant. So an example of a function would be something like this. Delta 137 equals determinant of the first vector, the third vector, and the seventh vector. Okay, that's a nice function on this space. That can't be all them because there's infinitely many of them. Here's another function on the space. I take these two vectors and I take their cross product. That's a vector. I do that also for this and for this. So I took the cross product of three vectors. And once I have three new vectors, I can take its determinant. And that's another nice function on this space. So that function looks like v1 cross v2, or determinant of v1 cross v2, v3 cross v5, and v6 cross v8. Right? So objects like this are called SL3 webs. They're used to compute like the Kaufman bracket for UQSL3. Yeah, UQSL3. So what is a web? I'm only going to say kind of quickly. So a web, first let me just say like an SL3 tensor diagram is something, it's bipartite and trivalent on the interior vertices. So something looking like this, basically, as long as you have that recipe, you can keep taking cross products or something like that, and you get some functions on your space. But these things can get really complicated. In a web, so by the way, each such thing gives me a function on my space, and functions of this type span the space. However, they're not a basis. Like, there's lots of relations amongst them. So what is a basis is a web is a tensor diagram. So I allow crossings here, by the way. It's legit for a tensor diagram to, like, I could have drawn, instead of here, I could have drawn something like this. That would have been totally fine. OK. But a web is a tensor diagram that is planar and without interior faces that look like this. So no 2 cycles and no 4 cycles on the interior. It has to be even because of bipartiteness. But. And it's a fact that using like diagrammatic relations amongst these tensor invariants, I can always write everything in this form. And the surprising fact is that things like this are a basis. That's due to Greg Cooperberg. Basically, I'll just say for G39, and the story for G48 is pretty similar, but so theorem. Every cluster variable in G39 is a web, which means it has this planar representation that can also be written as a tensor diagram without internal faces. So there's like 2 different conditions here. One is that you're a web, which means you can be written in a planar way. The other way is you're allowed crossings, but when you, like, once you have crossings, you can get rid of all the interior faces. And certain webs have this property, and certain webs don't. And the ones that have this property are exactly the cluster variables. But things like this, if you have a diagram without interior faces, then it can be written as a bunch of cross products, basically. So every cluster variable comes from iterating cross products. Like, this thing is a bunch of cross products, but as soon as you have an interior face, it's like a little bit harder to think of something as a cross product. And okay. So that's the theorem. And furthermore, the clusters consist of such things, such that when I multiply them, I get a web back. So whenever you have a basis for an algebra, you can say, when is it true that I take 2 elements of my basis and multiply them and get another basis vector back? In principle, it's like a sum of basis vectors. And the claim is, if I take 2 cluster variables, I can determine if they're in a cluster, if and only if, when I multiply them, it planarizes to give me just a single term, not a sum of a bunch of terms. And the proof of this is just to use the braid group action, check a bunch of stuff on a computer, and verify that the braid group action preserves this description. And this description is expected to be true for G3N, and this is a conjecture of Fomin-Pilyovsky, so I can prove it for G39 now. So this confirms a conjecture of Fomin-Pilyovsky for G3N. Basically, the same recipe is supposed to be true for always, but I can only prove it here. And the reason I can prove it here is because it's tame type. And so the group is big enough to capture everything. Okay. I could say more, but that's pretty much what I had to say. Yeah.
I remember in stuff that I read a long time ago correctly. Filiowski has also used these web.
Yeah, to do
some kind of jeu de tech hand.
That's right, yeah.
So can you see anything like that?
The thing he proves is basically that there's a bijection between. First of all, the slight difference between the way I'm thinking about webs and the way he was thinking about webs is his rule is, for example, here in this thing I drew, I have two edges connecting to this vertex.
Yeah.
Which means I'm using the vector v5 twice in my function. For him, a definition of a web is you can't do that. So there's only finitely many webs once I fix the boundary. And what he proves is that, it was already known there's a bijection between webs and tableau, Sandor Young tableau, and he proves that promotion is rotation.
Yeah.
And so there's not really anything for me to say about rotation of webs.
Could you can view that as also in an SL2 action on the cross-map, the promotion action.
I guess I don't have anything to say about it. Yeah, sorry. I think the reason he thought about this stuff is because he already knew about webs. I mean, that's one true thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything similar you can say for K?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh. It's just. Defining a SLK web is kind of annoying because there are signs, but every Plucker coordinate is a web. And so what you can do is you can start with your favorite Plucker coordinate and you can act on it by the braid group and you get infinitely many cluster variables that are webs because it turns out that these Artin generators preserve webness. And so tons and tons of cluster variables in the Grassmannians are webs, I just don't have any kind of proof that all of them are because because the group is only big enough in these two cases. Otherwise, it's just a nice large group. Yeah?
Does understanding this braid group action get too much closer to understanding the bigger cases?
I've spent my whole life in G3.9, and I just did G4.8 in the last few months. So I don't know. I've never even tried to compute in G3.12 and see what happens. But maybe in the next year.
Thank you.